I told the court that I'm wrong to imprison
you. Mr. Assume, you are not to address the jury.
There's too much being hid from you.
You need to be taken out of the court.
There's too much.
He was one small man in a giant wheel caught.
Well, I do wish to say that it's official that I'm wrongfully imprisoned right now.
Uncover, Season 7, Dead Wrong.
I asked him if he killed Pipple. He said yes, and I'd be next.
Available on CBC Listen and wherever you get your podcasts. This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Brent Bambury. This is Day 6.
Legalized gambling is here, and it is only continuing to grow.
Way too many commercials out there for betting. That's why we're addicted now.
The Americans estimated to legally wager more than $2.7 billion.
Every night you're disappointing someone.
Out of control, how sports betting threatens the legitimacy of the game. That's coming up on Day 6 today. Nenshi goes partisan.
I think he's shaken up this contest.
What the return of Nahed Nenshi means for Alberta politics. Dead in deep water.
They're allowing people to kind of move forward.
An elderly couple and their uncanny talent for search and rescue. And 25 years of 10 things I hate about you.
Young women even want to date these guys?
Revisiting the film through a drunk feminist lens. All today on Day 6. The 10 Things I Love About Easter Edition.
誰かに送金を依頼したことももちろん全く、ありません。
So I never bet on baseball or any other sports, or never have asked somebody to do it on my behalf. And I have never went through a bookmaker to bet on sports.
That is Shohei Ohtani and his new interpreter speaking earlier this week, and that is not how Major League Baseball wanted to go into opening day weekend. Ohtani is probably the best baseball player in living memory. He is supposed to be a global superstar in the making, but right now he's embroiled in a gambling scandal, along with his former translator, who allegedly stole more than $4 million from Ohtani's account in order to pay off money he lost betting on sports. And that's not all. Toronto Raptors forward Jonte Porter is under investigation by the NBA for what looks like an unusually high level of betting on his personal performance in two games. And coaches and players say they're being attacked online when their performance costs someone a bet. It's all happening in an environment where sports leagues and broadcasters are enjoying lucrative deals with single-game sports betting apps, newly legalized in Canada as of 2021. And Declan Hill says it's threatening to undermine fans' confidence in the games they love. Declan Hill is a journalist and academic who's written extensively about sports gambling and match fixing. Declan, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We've had two big sports gambling scandals involving pro athlete surface in just over a week. Is this a fluke or is this part of a larger trend?
Brother, it's the beginning of the end. Let's mark this in our calendars because this is the time, this is the downhill ski slope towards one of the professional sports leagues in North America ending. Because it hasn't actually just been two controversies around professional sports guys. There have been six, eight scandals in the last few weeks, none of which you have to be a conspiracy theorist or a crazed gambler or some sports fan nut to go, hang on a second, what's going on here? What is this? And I think at that moment when a sport can have good faith fans starting to doubt the credibility and the integrity of its product, it's going to die. And so I think this really is the beginning of the end. It's the end of the honeymoon period where everyone was running around saying sports gambling is going to, you know, fill all the potholes in our roads and a chicken in every pot and all that kind of malarkey. And now we're really seeing the results, which is these incidents of very, very serious credibility issues.
Let's talk about the effect on the fans because you've witnessed this when you did research in Asia. What happens if fans start having doubts about whether the games that they're watching professional athletes play are being rigged?
There's a graveyard of sports across the continent of Asia that have just been killed off by sports gambling related match fixing. because that's the fundamental thing about sports is that we love that glorious uncertainty. Mm-hmm. We'll get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. We'll drive hours. We'll do whatever it takes to watch real live action where we just, you know, we have no idea whether that underdog will pull off that glorious upset, whether, you know, the overdog, the New York Yankees will win yet again. We just don't have, you know, that is what we live for as sports fanatics. And as soon as we have that sense that it's all prearranged, it's the end. It really is the end.
And what did you see in Asia that confirmed that?
Look, China, as you know, and our listeners know, is one of the great economic powerhouses of the world now. And I remember going to Bird's Nest Stadium, which was that stadium built in 2008 for the Beijing Olympics. And there was a Chinese Premier League soccer match going on. And it's really difficult to overstate how corrupt Chinese soccer is. I think they've just put their third or fourth president of the Chinese Soccer League in jail. That's how bad the corruption and match fixing is. Anyway, there was a couple of thousand people there.
Oh, man.
Huge stadium that should be full of, you know, 60, 80, 100,000 people. You know, I've seen bus lines in downtown Beijing that had more people than watching that soccer game. And that phenomenon is repeated in Singapore, in Malaysia, in Thailand, in Vietnam, in the Philippines. Across the continent, many, many sports fans have just given up. The competitive advantage that Western sports had was that we were considered to be untouched by sports gambling.
Right.
And the actions, the events of the last couple of weeks have shown that era is over.
And I want to argue that it's different in North America simply because these organizations are old. They've existed for a long time. They're extremely profitable. They're powerful organizations that they will do something to stop this. I mean, maybe I'm being naive, but you do believe that we're moving into an era of gambleization. Why are you so pessimistic that won't happen, that these organizations, MLB, won't be able to withstand this?
I'm sorry, Brent. I love you. You're a brilliant man. But in this one, these guys have sold their souls to the devil. Yes, you're absolutely right. The National Football League, MLB, all these leagues are very profitable, very powerful leagues. But about 3-4 years ago, after the legalization of sports gambling, they made a decision to get a business marriage with the devil. And they thought, well, hey, this is a way of revenue expansion. We can increase the revenue. We can hook in our fans. We can bring in casual fans because they'll be hooked on gambling. And the problem is that they hadn't taken into consideration as to what's going to happen when fans start doubting, when fans start going, hang on a second, am I watching something real?
On Wednesday, NCAA President Charlie Baker told lawmakers that in states that have legal wagering on sporting events, that they should ban betting on individual player performances. Why is this a source of concern? And do you think Charlie Baker's on the right track here?
Yeah, I think he's waking up, but he's waking up a little bit too late. I mean, mate, this is something you should have done 5 years ago. Look, in NCAA, the athletes don't get paid.
Right.
If they're lucky, they may get some image rights. But for most athletes in NCAA, that's pennies, if at all. And what's happening is there's been a wave of sports gamblers phoning these guys up or going to meet them in, you know, in person or on social media and death threatening them. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, one of the incidents I'm talking about happened about 5 weeks ago in the NCAA that a young man hit a three-pointer in the final second of the game. Fantastic, right? Mm-hmm. If you are a sports fan, you love it. But if you're a gambler, he's just ruined the line. He's just cost a lot of people a lot of money. And so they started threatening the kid. And this is happening again and again and again with coaches and officials and players. And many of those players simply don't receive any money. And you're like, this is going to get really bad.
You, though, support legalized gambling. And do you think that there's a way of having it both ways, that we could allow sports gambling and we don't have to poison the game?
Absolutely. Here's some of the things that can be done. Right now, the Liberal government federally and the provincial government in Ontario can make match fixing illegal. Mm-hmm. At this moment, it is totally legal to corrupt a sports event in Canada. And you think of all the purported billions of dollars in new tax revenue that have come into the government coffers, and they haven't even spent 20 minutes amending the Criminal Code of Canada to say, hey, if you corrupt a sports event, that is a crime.
Yeah.
So if our government started to do that, if our government put in what they did in Australia when they had a liberalization and legalization of sports gambling there, which was a dedicated unit of sports experts and police officers to make sure that there was no sexual abuse, there was no doping, and there was no match fixing. That's what we need to protect our sports. And hey, if they have collected billions of dollars of, quote, new tax revenue from gambling, they should put a little bit of it aside to protect athletes and the sports.
I want to finish talking about Shohei Ohtani, because here's an athlete that's probably the best baseball player in a century. He just signed a huge contract to play in one of the biggest markets in the game. And it's all beginning with this cloud over him. What do you think the effect of that is on baseball, on the sport, and the fans?
So you have a potential superstar. You have a potential credibility question hanging over his shoulders. Anytime he makes an error or a mistake in the next couple of seasons, people will be raising their eyebrows. And again, our listeners will have that moment sometime in the next week, month, season, where they're going to look at a sports event and go, hang on a second. I wish that guy on Brent Banbury's show wasn't right, but it's now in my head and I can't get rid of it. I'm just going to switch off sport. I can't take this any longer.
Declan Hill, thank you very much for joining us. Have a great holiday weekend.
Thanks, Brent.
Declan Hill is a journalist and investigative academic in New Haven, Connecticut. Here are some other stories we're keeping an eye on this weekend. A 2-year-old orca calf is still stranded off the northwest coast of Vancouver Island. The calf is trapped in a tidal lagoon where its mother died last weekend when it was sealed off by a low tide. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada and the Ihattasut First Nation have been trying to lure the calf out into deeper waters to reunite it with its pod. The tides this weekend were too low for the calf to safely swim over the sandbar that's blocking it in, so the teams plan to resume their efforts next week. The Ihattasut First Nation has named the calf Brave Little Hunter. And
the Biden administration should not issue assurances. They should drop this shameful case that should never have been brought.
Julian Assange is once again waiting to find out if he will be extradited to the United States. Britain's High Court has asked the U.S. government for assurances that if extradited, Assange will be allowed to speak freely and will not be sentenced to death. Assange is the founder of WikiLeaks, which published confidential national security documents in 2010 and 2011. Supporters say the leak exposed unlawful U.S. military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan. U.S. authorities say Assange endangered lives by publishing the material. If the U.S. complies with the assurances, a final hearing could take place on May 20th. Still to come on Day 6, Nahed Nenshi's big move into Alberta provincial politics.
I think all of the momentum is on his side.
It was a romantic gesture to put other rom-coms to shame. Heath Ledger leaping across school bleachers, serenading Julia Stiles in 10 Things I Hate About You.
I love you, baby, and if it's quite all right, I need you, baby.
This film marks its 25th anniversary this weekend, and that means people are carving out time to rewatch the movie and to reflect on how Heath Ledger was a total babe.
He really is so charming in this movie. And he like smashed his way into the American teen girl consciousness.
That's Isabel Zotin.
I am a stand-up comic based in Toronto, Ontario.
Isabel hosted a 25th anniversary film screening of 10 Things I Hate About You with B. Kwame.
I am a writer and media personality.
The screening was part of a series called Drunk Feminist Films. The hosts provide commentary as the movie plays and encourage audience participation.
So we had a lot of different interactive things for people to just yell out and comment on. We yelled out forsooth anytime we heard like Shakespearean references, which was quite often.
I burn, I pine, I perish.
If you don't remember, or if you've suppressed the memories, the film is from an era when Hollywood insisted the best place to find cool teen stories was Shakespeare. 10 Things I Hate About You is a modern retelling of The Taming of the Shrew.
My biggest takeaway about it, watching it in adulthood, is I'm really surprised at the character of Kat, because it was the 90s and she was a character who was written to be
the shrew.
A shrew. but she's so intensely likable, and the movie only works if you like her.
You forget I don't care what people think.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't. You don't always have to be who they want you to be, you know.
The film is written by Karen McCullough and Kirsten Smith, and they're two women who look just like Kat. And so they wrote a really good female blonde American character.
This story is about two sisters, Kat and Bianca.
Kat is, you know, quite steely and hard. Bianca is the younger, more popular sister. But because their father has a rule that Bianca can't date until Kat dates, there's a whole ploy that gets put into place to get somebody to take Kat out so that Bianca is able to date.
Would you be willing to make it your problem if I provide generous compensation?
You're going to pay me to take out some chick.
Like many stories from the 90s and also the 17th century, not everything about it holds up in the present day.
Just the idea itself of the story of bribing a young guy to take out a young woman so that some other young guy can get access to another young woman. It's like, do these young women even want to date these guys? It's just like, who has agency and who doesn't?
But Isabel and B say the film acts as a time capsule reflecting life at that time.
The idea of popularity and popularity as currency in high school and how it really makes or breaks your entire existence in that kind of time frame of life. As a black woman who was a black girl, I can relate to Gabrielle Union kind of being this character who doesn't have a story, doesn't have a last name, is there to just kind of facilitate the plot for somebody else.
Because I like my Skechers, but I love my Prada backpack.
But I love my Skechers.
That's because you don't have a Prada backpack.
Oh.
And just fades in the background and you kind of forget about her. We had a joke at the event where if you saw a scene where it featured three white kids and one black kid, we yelled at Y2K diversity. And I was like, this was basically every day of my life when I was a teenager.
And the romantic relationships in the film could get quite questionable.
None of the characters really get to know each other. Cameron, to me, is the cringiest character because he falls in love with Bianca right away, saying that he knows her, he knows her soul, she's pure.
Look at the way she smiles and look at her eyes, man. She's totally pure. You're missing what's there.
He pursues her so hard and he puts so much energy into it. All for this girl who he sees for a fleeting moment, and his friend tells him she's no good. So that's the evidence he's going off of. And then he just throws himself into it wholeheartedly. It's just cringy because it reminds us of how deeply we felt about things when we were young and how we just, that stage when you're jumping into things with both feet. So it's cringy not in that it's inaccurate or it's poorly written. It's cringy in that it reminds us, remember when you used to do this?
But whether it was laughing at the memories or yelling at the screen, Bea and Isabel say sharing the movie with others made the experience better.
The thing I love about these events, both as a host and as an audience member, is being in those spaces and seeing other people pick up on things that maybe I didn't pick up on. It broadens your mind to this piece of art that maybe you've seen a million times before, but doing it in this communal space and having other people comment on what they see just really expands the idea of what this thing is and how it kind of fits into your life.
B. Kwame is a writer and media personality in Toronto. Isabel Zotin is a stand-up comedian. They hosted a 25th anniversary drunk feminist film screening of 10 Things I Hate About You.
So today, I'm announcing that I will be ending my campaign to be leader of the Alberta NDP.
And with that, Nahed Nenshi's leadership bid got a huge boost. On Tuesday, Rocky Pancholi withdrew from the Alberta NDP leadership race and threw her support behind former Calgary Mayor Nahed Nenshi. Nenshi announced his leadership bid 2 weeks ago, and he's having an impact.
In the span of a week, NAHED has more than doubled the size of the Alberta NDP's membership.
Nenshi is the clear front runner, but not everybody is happy about that, including the other remaining candidates.
I'm a little bit disappointed to hear about Racky's decision. I don't think this leadership race should be a coronation.
And while Nenshi is undoubtedly popular, he also has a lot of critics in the province.
I'm from Edmonton, and we weren't really big fans of Nenshi when he was a mayor down here, so I don't know. It's going to be very tough for him.
The NDP leadership vote isn't until June, but already change is happening in Alberta politics. Joining us to talk about the race and what's ahead are Lori Thorlickson, a political science professor at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, and Dwayne Bratt, who's a political science professor at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Lori, Dwayne, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Brent.
Good morning, Brent.
Dwayne, I'll start with you. What were your thoughts when you heard that Racky Pancholi dropped out of the race and threw her support behind Nahed Nenshi?
It did surprise me because I thought she had a shot at the leadership. I don't think she was in the top two, but we've seen lots of leadership battles where someone comes up the middle, and I think Racky was going to be everybody's second choice. She is smart. She is competent. She has reams of charisma. I really believe that she is a future leader of the NDP, just not now. Endorsing Nenshi, I think, just solidified his front runner status, but it was the explanation. And basically, she said they got the new membership numbers from the party. Mm-hmm. And since Nenshi had entered, the numbers had doubled in the span of a week. And so she just realized, how can I keep campaigning? How can I keep raising money when it is clear that Nenshi is going to win on the first ballot?
Lori, have you ever heard of anything like that, of memberships doubling within a couple of weeks of a candidate stepping in?
Well, I think it's really remarkable, and it just shows how much I think he's shaken up this contest. No, it's quite remarkable.
He was a popular mayor in Calgary mostly, but there is this urban-rural divide in Alberta, as there is in the rest of the country as well. But what do you think, Dwayne? Will Nahed Nenshi be as popular or be popular in the rest of the province?
Well, the question was Edmonton.
Right.
You know, there is a huge Edmonton-Calgary rivalry. And being a mayor of Calgary does not actually help you in Edmonton. And not being a member of the NDP, as Nenshi is, does not help you in the NDP stronghold of Edmonton. So when he holds a rally and it is standing room only, you know, and there's, you know, 700-800 people there, that was a sign of power. That was a show of force that Nenshi had. The NDP is not going to find a leader who's going to do well in rural Alberta. They mm-hmm. are an urban party. Where they do need to break in, though, are the small cities of Red Deer and Lethbridge and Medicine Hat and some of the suburbs like Airdrie and Spruce Grove and Sherwood Park. That's the NDP's challenge. It's not the cities and it's not rural. It's the small cities and the suburban community.
Lori, as somebody who lives in the capital, though, what did you make of the fact that rally was standing room only earlier this week?
Well, I thought it was great news for him, and I think also really significant that he got Racky's endorsement, because this is an endorsement from an Edmonton candidate. And so this is where he needs to break through. We need to keep in mind that the whole question, the whole matter of winning the leadership race is quite different. It's a very different contest from winning a provincial election. Mm-hmm. And so winning over Edmonton is a key job that Nahed faces.
Nenshi was mayor of Calgary for 11 years. So that's a long time for people to find things they don't like about him. If you were the UCP looking for ammunition in his record as mayor, what would you latch on to? Dwayne.
Oh, I think the increases in property taxes, they will focus on some of the divisions that existed on the council. There were episodes of some arrogant behavior. People talk about how the longer Nahed was mayor, he became more arrogant. Well, trust me, as someone who knew him before he was mayor and worked with him at Mount Royal, he had a pretty good ego before he got into politics. But it's the conservatives that are mad at him, right? And these are conservatives who I don't think ever voted for him. These right. are conservatives who are hardcore UCP supporters. So I don't think he needs to worry about those folks.
Lori, what do you think of the fact that he avoided partisan politics for the first part of his political career. And now he's going to lead one of the parties, or he may lead one of the parties into the next election.
Well, you know, I think it gives him, in one sense, it gives him a lot of flexibility, too. He's trying to, he has this tightrope to walk, and on the one hand, avoiding being branded by any one party's baggage from the past, mm-hmm. yet at the same time, trying to convince the party that he's one of them and that he is NDP enough to lead the party. And yet, you know, going forward, if he wins the leadership, he's probably, I would think, going to try to make some quite broader, more centrist appeals.
Right, right. And there's also the question, like, Pierre Poilievre had his Axe the Tax rally in Edmonton on Wednesday, which was a huge event. And Alberta Premier Danielle Smith has been quite vocal about her criticisms of the federal carbon tax. Laurie, do you think that Nenshi's going to be forced to come down on some position on the tax?
I think he'd probably be pushed in that direction, but he doesn't have to say anything right now. I think he can keep that out of the discussion when it, the first task is this leadership campaign. We've got a federal election coming up mm-hmm. before the next provincial election. And so that really changes the competitive context a lot. And so I think that can work to his advantage. You can see already that he's highlighting a lot of cost of living issues yeah. and trying to turn those a bit to his advantage.
We're already seeing the other NDP leadership candidates distance themselves from the consumer carbon tax. And bear in mind, the NDP, when they came into office in 2015, introduced a provincial carbon tax before the federal government did. Right. But Sarah Hoffman, Racky Panchelli, Kathleen Ganley, they've all talked about getting rid of the consumer tax. So I think Nenshi will adopt the same thing. There is huge political opposition to it, even if it makes good policy. And I think that's something that Nenshi would probably say, is that he can understand the policy applications. It's just bad politics right now.
So at the Juno Awards last weekend, Tegan and Sarah made a point of calling out Danielle Smith and her proposed policy of outing transgender youth in schools. Dwayne, how much does that policy work against her and shift support to Nahed Nenshi?
I think those are separate questions. I think Smith currently is on the side of majority public opinion, but we right. don't know the implications of that. It's easy to demonize a minority, and we don't base human rights on, you know, 50% plus one. But as a motivation for Nenshi to run, he appeared at a rally a week after Smith announced her anti-trans policies, and he mm-hmm. gave a very fiery speech. It really resembled a campaign speech to my ears, and sure enough, it did. And bear in mind, Nenshi has a long history with Danielle Smith and right. had told a story about, you don't need to know, worry about Danielle and trans issues or gay rights. I've known her for a long time. You know, you've got nothing to worry about. And in the rally, he says, I apologize for that because she is someone to worry about.
I'm wondering about a slogan, the slogan that he's adopted for all of us. Laurie, what do you read into that? Is it just about the LGBTQ community when he talks about Alberta for all of us, or is there more to it than that?
No, I think it's a broader slogan. I think it's one that's he can probably use to capture his economic policies as well. I think it's, if you look at some of his messaging around healthcare and around education and economic growth for the province, the all of us, I think, fits with this attempt to, you know, to set out a path of inclusive growth for Albertans.
Dwayne, Laurie just mentioned healthcare, which has been a huge issue in Alberta with the changes to the Alberta Health Services. And then there were some prominent scandals with Alberta healthcare in the last couple of years. Where do you think healthcare is going to fit as the leaders face off?
So, I mean, healthcare is always a big story for the NDP. You know, they see themselves as the party to defend public healthcare. This may be one of the challenges that Nenshi might have with the hardcore NDP supporters, because is he more open to some of the experiments about, let's say, allowing private laundry services or private cafeterias? You know, privatization in a single payer system would replicate some of his purpleness in balancing between, you know, left and right, that would not work in an NDP. To them, it's not just about a single payer. It really is about public health. And so far, he hasn't talked about healthcare in that deep way. It's more broad about protecting healthcare that you would expect anybody running for the NDP would say.
Laurie, as you mentioned, the provincial election is still a couple of years away, but if, as you look over the horizon, past those mountains, what do you see there? What do you think the issues will be in the province? Health, climate, housing? What do you think will resolve into the most salient issues?
Oh, well, we've got a few years to go yet. It's hard to see. I think climate as an issue will only intensify. And I think the interesting thing looking ahead to, when we finally get to a provincial election, we'll have gone through a federal election. Chances are pretty good that we'll have a different party in power federally, and that's going to change the dynamics enormously. Like very often, we find in Alberta, the United Conservative Party doesn't often compete against its provincial opposition as the key opposition. They like to campaign against a federal opposition. And so when we have, if the Conservative Party wins the next federal election, I think that would make things a little bit easier for the NDP because there will be the opportunity to take any grievances that Albertans have about federal policy and use that as, something that the NDP can campaign against to help put a little extra wind in their sails in their provincial campaigning. Because we can use this cross-level blaming.
Right, right. When that happens, Laurie and Dwayne, is there any doubt, does either of you have any doubt that Nahed Nenshi will be the next leader of the Alberta NDP?
I mean, elections do strange things. But if I was a betting man, absolutely. I think all of the momentum is on his side. I wondered about him entering the race late, whether that would hurt membership sales. But he held a rally for volunteers a couple days after he launched, and it was a packed room. And then he goes up to Edmonton, and it's a packed room. And so, yeah, I would expect him to be the next NDP leader.
Laurie, are you putting money on Nahed?
I think I would as well.
Dwayne and Laurie, thank you very much for being with us. It was fun to talk.
Okay.
Okay, thanks very much, Brent.
Yeah, you're welcome, Brent.
Dwayne Bratt is a professor of political science at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Laurie Thorlickson is a political science professor at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Still to come on Day 6, an uncanny story about science and empathy and retrieving bodies from the depths. We meet the author of Back from the Deep.
They're providing something essential.
The next thing I know is I wake up and I just remember like something bad happened to me last night. Somebody hurt me.
This is Carrie Lowe's story.
Carrie did everything, quote unquote, right. She reported right away.
Her legal team says police systematically mishandled her case.
Meanwhile, her attackers remain at large.
I'm Maggie Rahr, and this is Carrie Lowe Versus. Available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
I'm Brent Bambury. You're listening to Day 6 from CBC Radio. We're on public radio stations across the United States. You can listen on demand with the CBC Listen app, and we're available wherever you get your podcasts and at cbc.ca/day6. I'm thinking me. That is pop star Hatsune Miku. She's going to be performing in Canada this spring. She's not super well known here yet, but she's a pretty big deal in Japan.
She stars in music videos. She's appeared in commercials for all kinds of like brands, ranging from like high fashion to like convenience stores here in Japan. And she's just put on tons of sold out shows across Japan. And you go to these places and it's thousands and thousands of people watching this Vocaloid hologram on stage, but like losing it as if she's a real person.
That's Patrick Saint-Michel. He lives in Tokyo. He writes about Japanese music and pop culture. And yes, you heard him right. While Hatsune Miku is hugely popular, she isn't exactly real. She's a Vocaloid and a hologram.
Vocaloid is a singing synthesizer software that allows users to create their own electronic voice from their computer, from the comfort of their own home. Users buy the software, they install it, and then they basically use a digital audio workstation to create their own synthesized singing voice.
So just to make sure this is clear, Vocaloid was developed as a digital instrument that lets you create computer-synthesized vocals, but it's become much more than that.
So Vocaloid was developed in the 2000s, and there were efforts in the early part of that decade to sort of sell it as a pure, like, instrument, a digital instrument. But it didn't really become a phenomena in Japan until one company, Krypton Future Media, created a character to go along with the software. And put said character on the box, and then it started selling like crazy.
And yes, that character is Hatsune Miku.
She, quote-unquote, debuted in 2007, and she sort of helped turn Vocaloid into a phenomenon because she appeared on the box and sort of gave a character to this, what ultimately is an instrument. She kind of plays a lot of different roles in Japan's music industry. For a lot of artists and creators, she's kind of like a muse and even an instrument, the way that people use her vocal tracks. But at the same time, she's also become a performer in her own right.
Okay, so far, so curious. But as a fan, can you really connect with a hologram?
There's definitely a connection between fan and artist, even if the artist is a virtual one, like a Hatsune Miku or an avatar for Vocaloid. Part of it to me is people like the character of Hatsune Miku the same way that I think a lot of people like anime characters or, to a slightly different degree, virtual YouTubers. But at the same time, they also like the idea she represents, which is she's kind of a way that anyone can become a producer. Since Hatsune Miku and Vocaloid at large is ultimately an instrument, something you buy, put on your computer, and then create yourself, everybody in theory could be a Vocaloid artist. And there's just dozens upon dozens over the past, almost two decades now, of people who've just like taken this software and become a dance pop maestro or like a bedroom rock artist using Vocaloid. And from Vocaloid, there's just all kinds of other artists that people sort of come to and are like, oh, I like this producer. I like this singer who started out covering Hatsune Miku songs, but now has become like an actual J-pop superstar. So Vocaloid is almost like its own community. And within there, it's very easy to develop connections both with characters and real people using those characters to create something new.
Okay, but can Hatsune Miku move a crowd live?
I saw Hatsune Miku live in, 2012 or 2013 for the first time at Yokohama Arena, so just outside of Tokyo. And it's very jarring at first because you're in this giant arena that's held like American superstars and like J-pop luminaries, but you're there to see a projection of an anime performer. But, you know, there's an actual band delivering actual music and, you know, it's sold out and there's all these people just totally into it, like absorbing the moment.
Patrick Saint-Michel writes about Japanese music and pop culture. Hatsune Miku will be in Vancouver next week and in Toronto next month. Thanks to our intern, Ishita Chopra, for producing this story.
We're scanning the bottom of the reservoir And we're looking at a range of 98 feet from edge of screen to edge of screen.
That's Gene Ralston. He and his wife, Sandy, are both retired scientists from Idaho. For almost 25 years now, they've been searching for and recovering the bodies of people who drowned or went missing in lakes and rivers across the U.S. and Canada. The Ralstons are now counted among the best in the world when it comes to search and recovery. And one of the tools they rely on is an advanced sonar system.
It helps to even up the odds, and that allows you to search water deeper than divers can dive and creates images of obstructions on the bottom as well, and it helps keep divers safe.
But this sonar technology is just a tool. According to writer Doug Horner, the Ralstons have an uncanny ability for finding bodies lost underwater. And he says they also fill another crucial role, accompanying and caring for the people who are grieving the loss of a loved one. Doug Horner's new book is Back from the Deep, How Gene and Sandy Ralston Serve the Living by Finding the Dead. Doug Horner is in Calgary. Doug, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good morning, Brent. Thanks for having me.
You met the Ralstons years ago, and you spent time on the water during searches with them. But what drew you in the first place to this incredible story of Gene and Sandy?
Yeah, I think the Ralstons have a really remarkable story to share. And the work of underwater search and recovery specialists, too, is something that, you know, unless you go through it, an experience of having someone you know drown, it's not a field that people are very familiar with, and it's really sort of time and labor intensive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it deserves more attention and probably more public resources. So I think I was drawn to, you know, the kind of remarkable and unique story that Gene and Sandy have to share, but then also, you know, the field of underwater search and recovery as well.
Their abilities in that field seem unparalleled, but then there's also just their character and how suited they are for the emotional aspect of this work, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But they didn't set out to do this work. How did they end up there?
They have like a really unique professional background that kind of equipped them, you know, with a lot of the equipment and skills. They worked as independent environmental consultants. You know, they ran their own firm. Mm-hmm. You know, so they were doing a lot of work on the water. They also had been involved just based on the fact that they had, you know, the right equipment. You know, they've been kind of helping their local fire department or search and rescue teams do rescues on rivers around Idaho.
Right.
But, you know, it wasn't long, I think a couple of weeks after they got all this gear up and running and, you know, they found their first person who had drowned, and I think it was on Bear Lake in Utah in the fall of 2000. And the kind of gratitude, the sort of emotion that the family expressed to them, like how grateful they were that the Ralstons were able to recover. And it was a young man. I think he was in his early 20s. That made a really big impact on them. Mm-hmm. And then also I think like word spread relatively quickly, you know, that there was this couple from Idaho who had this new technology that could find people in water, and they started getting calls pretty quickly.
Right, and they make their services available basically for free. They simply ask the families that contract them to cover their gas expenses, which is pretty amazing. But there's something about them as people. There's something about their character. You've watched them interact with grieving families, and you've seen the way that they talk to them. What is it about their character that makes them so effective in that role?
They kind of make themselves emotionally kind of available, and they're not kind of afraid to make personal connections with families, which I think goes a long way to what, you know, makes them stand apart from other search groups and also why they stay in contact with a lot of the families for years after a search happens, whether it's successful or not.
You write about the 2002 search for Blanche and Russell Warren. This is a married couple. They were last seen in 1929 in Washington State near Lake Crescent, and then they were never seen again. Can you tell me about the Warrens?
So they were headed back home. They lived in a logging camp just on the northwest coast of Washington State. And they had two young sons. They left their sons at home and, you know, never returned. And this was July of 1929. It's an example, I think, of how It's incredibly difficult for the family, of course, but it can also get under the skin of like a community. And I think this is an example of a case that was passed on over sort of three generations. Mm-hmm. So there was the original sheriff that did everything possible with what tools were available to him in 1929. He suspected they'd gone off the road and into Lake Crescent. The highway that, you know, the Warrens were last seen on sort of follows the southern shore of Lake Crescent. So he did everything he could. And then there was a man, Bob Queso. He was from Port Angeles, and he took up the sport of scuba diving in the 1950s, you know, learned about the Warrens and sort of did a bunch of his own investigative work, built a big file on the case and conducted a bunch of, you know, sort of search missions as a scuba diver in the lake. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those lakes. I mean, this, I think Lake Crescent is 600 feet deep in some places.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's so deep.
Yeah. So Bob Queso passed it off to someone with the National Park Service, Dan Popbriand, who organized a bunch of dives. Not many people realize like scuba divers are pretty limited in how deep they can go. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's like 98% of scuba divers don't go below 130 feet.
Yeah.
So Popbriand and his team thought they had a pretty good idea where the car was, but they couldn't find it. So they called in the Ralstons and, yeah, they were able to locate it kind of within a few hours of launching their boat. So it was kind of a mystery that had kind of haunted this community for 73 years. And the Ralstons were able to help kind of resolve it within a few hours.
Now, the Warrens' sons were dead by then, but they had children of their own. What did the success of the Ralstons in locating this vehicle and some of the bones of the deceased mean for the family and community?
For the two sons, like having their parents vanish was something that, you know, their grandchildren mentioned. It was something they could never really talk about. It was just kind of too painful of a memory to revisit. So to finally get those definite answers, even if it was 73 years later, and then not only that, but to have somewhere that they could go to kind of remember and pay their respects to their grandparents meant the world to them.
And this is something I think that your writing really excels at, Doug, in exploring what the meaning of the artifact of the human body and human remains is for people that are grieving. And one other family who lost a loved one in the water said about the Ralstons, "We were lost souls, but as long as they're here, we have that hope. They gave us that. They were guiding us through." And you land on this idea of the Ralstons as modern versions of the mythological figure of the ferryman. What brought you around to seeing them that way? Tell us about how you came to that conclusion.
Spending time with them, you know, I think I was just kind of naturally drawn to making comparisons to that myth. You know, and then I did a bit of reading about the myth of the ferryman. And it's one of these stories that, you know, people who study myths can't sort of point their finger and say, this is the time and place that the story came from. Like it sort of pops up, mm-hmm. you know, different versions, but the same elements throughout time and across different cultures. So the Ralstons are using this, you know, powerful new technology, but they're doing it to kind of satisfy this primordial instinct. Caring for the dead is fundamental to being human. It's something we've done, you know, since the beginning of time. So I feel like the myth kind of highlighted that ancient character of the service they're providing. And then the concept of purgatory in the myth of the ferryman, I think, really applies to, you know, missing persons cases.
So the myth of the ferryman is that this is the entity that takes the soul from their earthly existence across this expanse and then into the afterlife.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a guide for the souls of the recently deceased. And there's usually a barrier of some kind that the guide takes these souls across, and it's usually water. Mm-hmm. And implied in the myth is that you can sometimes get stuck in kind of no man's land without the help of this guide. Mm-hmm. And the water sort of presents this insurmountable barrier. For many people, it's absolutely essential, you know, that they find the remains of their lost loved one. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that means, you know, they'll show up at the lake. They'll sort of feel bound to that lake until they're able to recover those remains. The Ralstons, they'd be the first ones to say they don't provide closure for people. They don't believe that there's sort of this finish line for grief and that someone can kind of reach this end point. But mm-hmm. they're providing something essential. And I think it is that they're allowing people to kind of move forward and kind of cross a barrier that they couldn't cross on their own.
In your book, you include a discussion of The Work of the Dead, which is a book by Thomas Lacker. And this is about the history of why people care or even go looking for a body that seems irretrievable. Why was it important to include that?
Yeah, he talks about how it's this instinct and kind of fundamental aspect of the human condition that we're sort of compelled to fulfill. Kind of what the Ralstons experience with families and some of what I observed when I spent some time with them. Biological death is kind of too fast. It's too abrupt for us to understand. And especially, you know, in the case of a drowning, when someone dies suddenly and unexpectedly and then goes missing.
Yeah, it's shocking.
Yeah, it's – I think there's sometimes like a sense of unreality associated with these types of accidents. And the Ralstons kind of have to deal with both sides of that equation. You know, they're aware of the person, the loved one who is missing, but then what's happening to this body in the water, you know, how it's decomposing and where it's moving and, you know, kind of that other physical aspect of this.
But they've become so good at this in this field that now they're quite famous within the field. And you've written that when Gene Ralston writes you, he'll forward a search request that he's received by email and he will say, it never ends. There's just so many requests coming their way. Gene turned 79 this year, and Sally Ralston's in her late 70s. How much longer do you think they can do this for?
They can sort of see it on the horizon when they're going to stop. It's hard work. Mm-hmm. I mean, you spend, you know, sometimes a search day lasts 10 hours. There's heavy equipment to move. They're often out there on their own, you know, on the water. Mm-hmm. They have to drive long distances to get there. So it is a physically taxing job. And, you know, I don't think there's ever been anyone quite like them to do this work. Mm. And I don't think there's sort of anybody who does this work to the same extent that they do who's going to be able to replace them.
Well, their story is pretty amazing. Thank you very much, Doug.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Brent.
Doug Horner's new book is Back from the Deep, How Gene and Sandy Ralston Served the Living by Finding the Dead. His book is being launched on Tuesday in the Studio Theater at Seaspace Marteloup in Calgary.
Time, weather, and
Riff from the Headlines.
And here we go. Riff from the Headlines, our weekly quiz. Three riffs linked by one story in the news. If you guess the story that links the riffs, you could win a Day 6 tote bag. First, here's a recap. This is last week's clue.
Stepping lightly, stepping brightly, with our books in hand. Going to the university to teach and help them understand.
If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long lost pal. I can call you Betty, Betty, when you call me, you can call me Al.
Paul Simon with You Can Call Me Al, The Pixies and Weird in My School, and Van Morrison with Madam Joy, and Donna White of Northport, Nova Scotia, correctly guessed the headline that we're looking for. Vermont State University announces a class based on the music of Weird Al Yankovic. Congratulations, Donna. A Day 6 tote bag will be on its way to you soon. It's big enough for a small accordion. Now, here's this week's clue.
And it's nothing like
And we're looking for the story that connects those riffs. Email us your answer, put riff from the headlines in the subject. Send it to day6@cbc.ca. Please include your mailing address because one right answer will be picked at random. The prize is a Day 6 tote bag. You can always hear the clues again anytime at cbc.ca/day6.
Time, weather, and
riff from the headlines.
Ah, yeah!
And that's our show for this week. Day 6 was produced by Lori Allen, McKenna Hadley-Burke, Sarah Melton, and Pedro Sanchez. Our senior producer is Gord Westmacott, and I'm Brent Bambury. It's 8 days to World Health Day, 1 day to Easter, and 7 days till we meet again on Day 6.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.